Everyone has something to say about the jazz scene in Philadelphia. Some people will tell you jazz is flourishing in Philadelphia. Others will tell you that there's fewer clubs than there used to be, and that it's no place for a musician to earn a living. We're going to take a look at the Philadelphia jazz scene as it's been over the past few decades. I have three guests with me in the studio who have been intimately acquainted with the jazz scene in Philadelphia: Jimmy Golden, Sam Dockery, and Jack Fields. Jimmy Golden was the house pianist at Billy Kretschmer's, which was on 16th and Ranstead Streets, at around 1940. And around 1945, he was the house pianist at the Downbeat on North 11th Street in Philadelphia. In 1946, he joined the Billy Eckstein Band. Sam Dockery, after playing with Art Blakey, spent around 1960 to 1964 as the house pianist at the Showboat. That was on Broad and Lombard Streets, where the Bijou is now. He also played and recorded with Art Blakey, as I said, and is featured on Clifford Brown's last recorded session, which was taped from a live performance at Music City in Philadelphia. My guest Jack Fields is a trumpeter and was the owner of the club The Blue Note, which was located on Broad and Ridge Streets and operated from about 1950 to 56. It featured musicians like Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, Dave Brubeck, Chet Baker. Ray Bryant was the house pianist there for some time. I'd like to welcome all of you to Fresh Air. Really great pleasure to have everybody here. What I'd like to do is just go around the table and ask each of you if you feel that there was a time in Philadelphia that was noticeably better than the other times for jazz. Jimmy Golden, can we start with you?
Well, in 1940 at Billy Kretschmer's, it was a traditional jazz room. He was a clarinetist in the pit band at the Earl Theater, and he had the place there, and the music, Teddy Walters, Bill Harris, a trombone player. He had clarinet, piano, guitar, and, like to say, trombone, another instrument. And there was no bass, you know, violin at all. And Teddy Walters used to play the bass lines, and whoever the guitarist was had to play the bass part. And it was interesting to watch go from there to the Downbeat, because that was a different scene altogether. You know, you met guys who were thinking, you know, more progressive type thing. And there were guys like Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Shavers, they were playing in Frankie Fairfax's band. They used to rehearse at the Strand Ballroom at Broad and Bainbridge. And there was quite a few guys around who were interested in the music itself, you know, like Dizzy. Well, I think he was, and he is now, really an articulate musician. And he promoted a lot of the younger guys, and the guys could come up and play. And Sam, did you ever come up and play at the Downbeat?
No, I never did. That's a little before me.
So that seemed like a good period in there where different, you could play at this more swing-oriented places and the places that were starting to...
Yeah, and then there were other clubs, like Philadelphia had about 7 or 8 clubs at later periods. In West Philly, the 421, North Philly, the Tropic, and Zanzibar, the Cafe Society. And I think that was the real era where younger guys, like today, there's no place for them actually to...
So you're talking about, what, the mid-40s?
Yeah, the mid-40s, yeah.
Jack Fields, is there a time you thought was real good?
Well, the 40s that Jimmy's referring to, I used to come and listen, so that puts Jimmy in a pretty old category. I'd come and listen both at the Downbeat and Kretschmer's. I had a big band in town at that time, an 18-piece band, and that was pretty much the scene in Philadelphia. It was a big band scene up to about 43. Most of us were inducted into the Army one way or another. I had an Army band for 3 years, the 86th Infantry, a very big infantry band, and that's how I spent my time. But it wasn't until after this period when I got out of the Army and the big band business was pretty much kaput. All the big band leaders had come out of the service and they found that they couldn't get work, is when we got into a completely changed scene, which initiated my thoughts about the Blue Note.
So
which we can talk about when you get around to Sam. And
Sam Dockery, is a period that... has struck you as being a real good period for jazz in Philadelphia?
Well, I started playing New Year's Eve, 1949. I came to Philadelphia, I think, the next 2 years, 2 years later, 1951. And I was already in love with jazz by the time I came to Philadelphia. So I met people, and... I was introduced to Jack Fields at quite early in my career. I mean, Jack Fields' club, Blue Note. I wasn't introduced to Jack Fields. But anyway, since jazz was new to me, and most of the jazz musicians, Jimmy Golden, I didn't know at the time. And Jack Fields, like I said, I didn't know him either. But I had an opportunity to hear Charlie Parker, and I felt jazz so strongly. I heard Bud Powell there. I heard Ray Bryant. So many fellas. Now, Ray Bryant I knew from a teenager when I was in Camden dancing. He would come to Camden with Mickey Collins' big band, and he would play the dances Saturday night over the pool. And that was during my jitterbug days. I'm really dating
Could you
myself.
Really dance a lot, Sam?
Very well, I'm afraid. Anyway, I heard Ray then as a youngster, and he played so well. Anyway, I heard him play to Jack Fields, and I was fortunate enough to be in the company of those musicians in Philadelphia at the time, and I absorbed as much as I could. And for me, the era from say from 52 until I started traveling with Art Blakey during the middle 50s, 56, was very fertile for music. I must add a sad note. During my tenure with Art Blakey, during the latter part of my tenure with Art, jazz in New York, I could see it dying slowly then. New York had changed quite a bit. Clubs would open and close. And the music was changing also slightly from traditional jazz as we know it to sure. avant-garde. Mm-hmm. They were beginning to play just with saxophones and conga drums. Right. No rhythm section, no piano, bass, and drums.
Right.
So, but still, the era that was most important to me was the early 50s up to the middle 60s. I grew quite a bit because I was around Jimmy Golden. I met him during that time. They had a lot of, besides Jack Fields, they had a lot of little clubs where jazz musicians could play and grow and learn.
Right.
So that was my time.
Do you remember, Jimmy Golden, what it was like during the period when the big bands were starting to fade out and when bop was starting to take over? What was happening in Philadelphia? Was the audience receptive to it? Were they ready for it? And what was happening to the clubs that used to have the big bands when bop started coming in?
Well, Ellie Lawrence had a band, a radio station band, which included Red Rodney and Buddy Savage and other local guys. And I think the radio kept that band together as much as anything else. As far as the salaries became a different story, because my first job in 1939 I played was $9 a week.
But they had no place left to go, Jim. There was no place for the big bands to play because
right, absolutely.
People had stopped dancing and started drinking. You know, the war ended, right?
And like Sam and was saying, the conflict between the traditional and the other thing, the audiences were becoming divided. People would go to concerts and they would boo one act and they didn't play bop or and they liked it and they didn't. And traditional, they would get those guys out of here, you know?
Don't you think with the advent of the big recording boom, that kind of helped to kill big bands?
Of course.
Because
it did.
People could sit home and listen to music
instead
of going out.
And then the union scale. The scale in the theater at the Lincoln Theater was $45 a week.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to play the Kiddies Hour, the Parisian Tailors Hour, the Amateur Hour, everything was included. You know, but the price, like even like Miles Jack as a club owner can tell you, some of these acts, you had to start breaking up the shows. You used to be able to go in the showboat any place and stand around, guys play all night.
Right.
But when your price goes up like Miles, $7,500, how can you sell and keep your place open? You know?
Yes, very difficult.
I've heard that there were a lot of places in Philadelphia, I guess in the 40s, maybe the 50s, that had, pit bands, theaters and stuff, where... supported
absolutely.
Bands, and I don't know what other places.
The Nixon Grand Theater used to be in Broad and Montgomery.
Jimmy Golden, I don't know whether you remember the old theater on Broad Street called The Fans.
40s and Market, sure.
That's
where I seen Lucky Miller make the band play.
The Fans, it was The Phase.
The Phase. On Broad Street? This was on Broad Street, wasn't it?
No, but Broad and Montgomery was the Nixon Grand.
Right.
Yeah.
And The Phase
that's
was on Market Street at 40...
I saw Spider Bruce at one of those theaters.
You
I remember
saw him right there. You know what
I was a kid
him?
At the time. I want to clarify that.
Sam, listen, can I tell you a real funny story? They used to have it at the Nixon Grand Theater, like Mal Hallett, all the white band attractions, Mal Hallett, Frankie Gall, and Tommy Dorsey. So in the pit band, they had the Sunset Royals Orchestra, Sol Harris, and they were doing all these arrangements like Who, Sonny, Marie. And at that time, Jimmy Lunsford's band, too, just before this, had been stranded here up on Ridge Avenue.
Yeah.
And so most of the cats were strung out tight, you know, for bread.
For money, right.
And so Sol Harris sold Tommy Dorsey arrangements.
That was the star of that big band area.
Sonny, and I was right there. You understand what I mean? I can see. Yeah. But $50 in a day like that.
Right.
In a time like that, the guys couldn't get back to Florida.
Right.
So when I hear Dorsey's recording of Marie, it's the same, you know, and people really don't know how closely people feel about music. You know, it can come from any source, you know.
Yes, that's true.
And basic American music. And Teddy Wilson revolutionized the art of playing the piano, I think, as far up until he came along. Most of the guys who played, well, you just play, like, but did the trombone player start to lose the C7?
I don't want to change the subject, but I believe that the recording industry did to musicians what automation did to people working. You know, they have so many machines now doing the work that a lot of people used to do, that a few people can do now. And the recording industry, you can get a group of musicians together to record an album, and you can get it distributed not only nationally but internationally.
But they use the same guys. They use the same guys.
Yeah, but my point is, it really limits the work that a musician can get.
Maybe we can get back to this a little later. I'd like to know, in the clubs that you all played in and own, so that includes what we have: the Blue Note, the Downbeat, the Showboat, Billy Kretschmer's. Were there your white clubs and your black clubs? Were there clubs that were predominantly clubs for white people?
Well, do you know,
clubs that predominantly
do you know
a
funny thing?
People?
No, it was not. It was
no, not as far as jazz was
no
concerned.
Siree. No, siree. I'll tell you the truth. Like, in those situations like that, it was never any thought. Jack can tell you himself, even his spot right there. There was never any thought of
The clubs were black and tan, but what happened is when you got into the progressive scene, I guess you would label that 50 era progressive.
Bob. Yeah, right there. Yeah, right. Yes. Sam is,
it has
when you got
right
into the 50 scene, then there became a decided division as far as the music presentation, the musician, and what they subscribed to. Okay?
Right.
Those people who subscribed to Bird School, Dizzy School, that was one segment. And there was the Brubeck and the Mulligan and the Chet Baker School.
Cool.
So you had a cool scene. You had the white scene from the West Coast.
Right.
You had
who
the black
from
scene
the
from the East Coast. And the two shall not meet, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
And they not only maintained that, but it goes on today. As far as the audience participation, the audience, I think, was interested in good sounds, good music.
Of course. Surely. And they supported, you know, when people tell me incidents, like, I know where people support anything that they like, even baseball teams, like even the black leagues, you know, 95% of the people who supported them, who had the money to go there, were white. The same thing with music. You find concerts.
You recognize
now
something good and you're going to go
and
see
it. Sure, and that has nothing to do with it. But the guys
that's
themselves
true
turn their backs, wear sweaters. How are you going to wear a sweater to work on the bench?
Now, that's the point that we're reaching. What happened from the point that I became involved as a club owner rather than a musician, we opened the Blue Note simply because this was the only way I had to go. I wanted to be amongst this type of person. I wanted to be associated with musicians. My life was as a musician. I felt good being in the company of Oscar Peterson. I felt good being in the company of Miles Davis. I felt good with Sonny Stitt. And so I made my life it was a dedication to be with these people. It wasn't a commercial.
And that's the way you conducted
approach
your club, too, I remember.
Absolutely.
That's the way it was.
Man,
absolutely.
It was fantastic in there.
The best atmosphere the I've seen.
With the musician, Sam, you know, working in a club, to have an owner this much sympathetic to your cause is great.
Very rare. But
was it
it's
rare?
Great,
I'm
telling you, but it's rare.
Course.
I've worked in New York. I remember when I left Art Blakey, I came home, and I didn't travel anymore from year 1957, 50, well, I traveled with Tiny Grimes, 58, but I left Tiny and came back home to study, and I didn't travel anymore until I went out with Roy Haynes, and we worked the Five Spot in New York. That's where Monk became world famous. That's the place where he got his name on the cover of Time magazine. But anyway, Teddy Wilson, I was with Roy Haynes, and Teddy Wilson was the group opposite us. Now, can you imagine? Teddy Wilson is an expensive act. And the tables and the chairs and the five spot were ridiculous. The chairs were ripped. They had leather chairs. The tables were falling down. I don't know. The piano was probably in terrible condition. The place was hideous. You know, and of course Teddy Wilson bought the mink coat Rolls Royce set. He brings that set out to hear him play. And the club was so disgusting, Jack. The lighting was terrible.
You want to drink, you wait an hour?
Can you imagine Teddy Wilson there? And the place was awful.
Sam, what was the club like where you were the house pianist at the Showboat? How was it for audience and for performers? How was it for performers?
Excellent. The club itself wasn't as comfortable looking as it might have been, but it was pretty good. The place was small and compact, and he had lighting, you know. But it could have stood some improvement.
The stairway there was really
But I think what we're failing to. Remember, and it's the bottom line, that people rarely open clubs for hobbies or for any philanthropic reasons, and the clubs prior to this were all owned by racket people. I mean, let's face it, anybody owning a club...
Well, you had to like jazz at all to open up a room and say, I'm going to have Art Blakey, Miles Davis.
And you had to
what I mean?
Right.
You had to love it, you know, really.
Exactly, and during the 50s, it proved itself that to do this, to run a club as a concert type establishment was not practical.
Absolutely.
It was not functional. And you could not possibly make money in Philadelphia or any other town.
Absolutely.
If you run a commercial type club where you're getting an admission, then, as Birdland did and a few others, then there's a chance to survive. But in Philadelphia, the bottom line was either do it as a hobby or get out of that business.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, if you talk to musicians, you're probably going to hear about the problems of not getting paid and not having pianos that are in tune and not getting treated well. And if you talk to club owners, you might hear stories about musicians not showing up for their gigs or showing up an hour late or something.
Both are true.
Both are true. What were some of your experiences, Jimmy Goldman?
Well, you know, Frank Sinatra had a great line in this movie, The Tender Trap. They were given a party. So they said, okay, well, we'll invite some musicians and then we'll get some people. You know. The club I was just working in, I asked the guy who was going to be there for 10 weeks, it was there, to get the piano tuned the first week, right? So he got it tuned the first week, so 10 weeks, right? It's almost 3 months. So around about the sixth week, it was really terrible. So I asked him, I said, would you get the piano tuned? He says, again?
Jack Fields, what were some of your experiences in this regard?
Well, there are certain people that I'd like to talk about that rarely come up in this type of discussion. Everybody talks about Miles and the fact that Miles is a bad boy and turns his back on the audience. And everybody talks about Bird. I had a very close relationship with Charlie Parker. He worked with me because we had an empathy for one another. But there were people that I brought in initially that no other clubs ever used in the jazz scene, such as Art Tatum. Nobody would use Art Tatum.
Absolutely.
Simply because he didn't draw commercially.
He had an audience, a discriminating audience.
He had a handful of people that understood what he was doing and would sit there and actually listen to what he was doing. And he was truly one of the great experiences that I've ever had in my life. I brought him 3 times a year. And the 3 times a year that I brought him into the club, he got lots and lots of money, even then.
Mm-hmm.
And he would draw 100 people a night, would be the top night that we had.
It's difficult to imagine.
But it was
the really
man of his
It was probably he and Eddie South was the other one that I mentioned to you. Eddie South was concertmeister with the Budapest Symphony, and one of the greatest violinists, one of the greatest musicians I've known in my life.
Really?
I have chills today when I hear
Billy
some of the things
was
that he does.
Piano his trio.
Oh yeah,
Billy Taylor.
Yeah, too. Eddie South, and the same thing. I would bring Eddie South back just so that I could be with Eddie South for a week and have him to myself. And I was not a rich man's son. I couldn't pay my bills, but this was an indulgence.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That I had to have. I had to have Eddie South with me.
Stuff Smith too. Did you like him, Mrs.
Smith? Not as much. Eddie South was something else as a person too.
Jimmy Jones and great. I'm sorry.
No. Yes.
What do you think musicians thought when they were coming into Philadelphia to play? Do you think that they expected it to be a receptive town or a place that it was going to be hard to get an audience? Jack, what was your feelings about that when people, when you were bringing people in, say from New York or, you know, from some other part of the country? Do you think that they had good feelings about Philadelphia?
Well, it varied to this extent. It was my experience that in Philadelphia, the bands or the individuals in progressive jazz, contemporary jazz, that did the best business were those that had some notoriety hung on them. Unfortunately, so that people would come out.
Curiosity seekers.
Right. People would come out to see Billie Holiday, and I have to admit that I had a little crass commercialism within me, because I would bring Billie three times, sometimes four times a year, to return to the club. And not because of her great quality any longer, because her quality was diminishing.
Yes.
But she just packed them in. People came from all over just to look upon her.
In that club of yours, I seen her do something.
Yeah, she had become a legend.
And she was quite a girl. She worked hard.
House full of hoodlums. Quiet
right.
as a pin.
Right.
And this chick and that piano player, the girl I was telling you about.
Just out of respect for what she had been, what she had done. But she was no longer, from a musician's standpoint, say that she had the quality that she could produce any longer. She had done so much to her body that physically she couldn't.
Well, Jack, don't you think her records with Teddy Wilson? I think that's a great piano player and singer combination.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, Teddy Wilson is... Teddy Wilson's one of the great pianists.
You know what he did, Sam? Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, I just want to say, as a piano player, I just want to speak to him on this point, Sam. I'm going to ask you a question, Sam.
Yes.
Like, I think in the evolution of piano playing that goes from, say, from Art Tatum, like he was speaking about, Faster Waller, James P. Johnson, great pianists, all these guys. I think Teddy Wilson started everybody else to go back and look in the book, because some of those arpeggios and things he was doing could not be, you couldn't hear it. Yeah. You understand? You had to go look.
Well, now I'll tell you. I heard Teddy Wilson. I know a lot of my musician friends are going to frown at me when they see me, but I don't care. I heard Teddy Wilson on Marion McPartland's program. Yeah. I think she has one on Mondays. Am I correct?
Yeah.
Terry. And Teddy Wilson, I think, she invites pianists to come on and speak and play piano with her and play themselves. Yeah. And Teddy Wilson has a... Not only does he have an innate jazz sense, he is fantastically prepared as a musician and a pianist.
An instrumentalist, sure.
Right, as a pianist, very well prepared. So when you hear this man play, you're hearing a Finnish pianist first, then you're hearing a jazz pianist.
Absolutely.
Yeah, incidentally, so that this doesn't become a chauvinistic show, he's talking about Marion McPartland and Mary Lou Williams and these two girls. Played often for us over here.
I want to get back to the idea of how people viewed Philadelphia. Jack, from what you were saying, I get the feeling that if you were a star or if you were legendary for one reason or another, that a lot of people would turn out to hear you, but if you weren't already legendary, it was going to be a little chancy. Sam, did it seem to you that if you wanted to be able to make a living and make a name for yourself, that you'd have to leave Philadelphia to do it?
I've often thought about that, and I've had that fact suggested to me over and over again. And I've also heard Cannonball say that if you want to do good, you do good at home first, then you do good. I'm getting, in my latter day of playing, I'm still not that old, I'm getting more, I feel more confident in myself as a pianist. People are respecting me more as a pianist, and I haven't left home now, and I don't know when. Since 64.
Were you the exception?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't. Are you speaking about Philadelphia musicians?
Yeah, Philadelphia musicians. Did Philadelphia musicians, you know, maybe, felt that they had to leave? Well, I had to leave.
People knew me before, but I like to think I've grown, so the ones that come back and heard me from knowing me, say, 20 years ago, you know, they're telling people that I'm growing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so maybe you do have to leave in order to get that initial.
I know in the context you're speaking of, I think the reason living in New York City is not the playing, it's the greatest city in the world. I don't care what you say. You have to go there and be an
You have to go there.
But I'll tell you, the living conditions, like Sam or Jack and myself, you know, now, it would be impossible to go back to a period where three or four guys stayed in one room. You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and all that stuff, to be around New York and play, like up in the Braddock and places like at Gene Ammons. There were plenty of guys, Sonny Stitt, all the guys, Bud, Kenny Doom, everybody. So if you don't want to actually live that way, after the job, what are you going to do? You're going to have to live in that sort of a situation if you don't have money.
Well, I think Terry means if you... in order to become recognized as a musician.
Can you take New York? Look how many great guys, Sonny Clark, all those guys who decided to make New York and challenge New York City.
Right. Not too many people heard of him.
No, but he was magnificent.
Yeah, he sure was.
Magnificent. With New York City.
Well, you know, Sonny died very early in his career.
Of course he did.
The greater part of his career was spent out in California.
See, he came east and Buddy DeFranco.
So he came east, he left California. I think Sonny Clark would have been better known if he had stayed in California longer, because he really had a name for himself, and he was recording with Shelly Man, you know.
He had
things going.
Sure.
So when you transplant yourself from one part of the country to another, you have the click to
deal with. There's no environment like New York, Sam, you know.
Yeah, but
there's
still...
There's no environment on Earth like New York
City. Yeah, but still, Sonny was an outsider, Sonny Clark.
That's what
coming
I mean.
To New York.
Yeah, right.
And he was
right.
treated as such.
Right.
And it's too bad he didn't stay around long enough. He would have gained his place.
There's another side to that question, too, Terry, as to whether a musician, as Sam Dockery and Jimmy Golden, has to leave Philadelphia in order to make a name. A number in that particular era that we're talking about, a number of the musicians, those who were the celebrities, those who were the stars of their day, the Dizzy Gillespies, Charlie Parker, Sonny Stitt, they would come into town with musicians, and this was sad, a very sad part of the business, with musicians who were sometimes very incompetent, and because they wanted to pay them very little bread. Very often, I have to criticize Disney. He would bring in musicians who weren't competent to back him up, who did a poor job.
Yes.
So that in a club like mine, when a musician came in, for instance, Charlie Parker used to come in, and Ray Bryant would be there as the house band, and he had just come off a scene where he had his own band or been through a whole thing with some very poor
piano players and poor drummers.
And he'd walk in on Ray Bryant. He want to steal Ray Bryant and take him with him. And he want a Fats Wright. And he want a Sam Dockery. You don't find this kind of musician with Dizzy Gillespie today. In fact, I don't even think he takes a band out with him anymore.
Well, he does, but it's so minuscule.
Actually,
the musicians that we offered and that were here in Philadelphia, and we had some really great musicians in Philadelphia.
Let's run through who some of the musicians that got started in Philadelphia are, who are names that everybody would recognize. Now,
well, let's talk about some of the drummers, you know, that were working here.
Tiny Collins.
And who we used to back up all of the top acts that came in, the top musicians that came in.
Oh, so many good.
Stan Levy, Ellis Tolman, Spex Wright. That was a fantastic musician, he was, man.
One of the great drummers.
And talking about
musician, even, not only
we used to do a thing with drummers. It was a very popular thing at the Blue Nut with Louie Belson and Buddy Rich. We did twice a year. We'd bring them in, and that's when we'd bring John Coltrane in.
Now there's a name, John Coltrane.
I think he did more to Blue Note than...
Listen, John Coltrane, when I first heard him in the downbeat, everybody was playing alto. This is another transition period as far as saxophones are concerned. Everybody was playing like Charlie Parker, right?
Everybody. Sonny Stitt.
Jimmy
Sonny Stitt especially.
Johnny's? Yeah, right. Jimmy, he brought him by the downbeat. He was playing alto. And I said to myself, when I first heard him, I said, well, he's going his own way eventually. You understand what I mean? Hmm. He wasn't playing like Bird. He was getting his...
You mean John Coltrane?
John Coltrane, of. Playing alto saxophone.
Ah.
And bing, 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 right away. Wow, this guy, he could tell.
He
right
had
away.
Developed his direction.
Yeah,
his
right, own his, you could see that he was going independent. Yeah. Thinking, you know, and yeah. he's that's another Philadelphia plus, you know. John Coltrane.
How do musicians react to Coltrane first? I mean, well, this is sometimes very threatening, I think, when someone is playing something real different.
Can I tell you that some musicians that were saying, telling Miles, like when Train first went with him, and these are guys I know, I wouldn't call their name for anything. Why don't you get rid of that guy? You know what I mean? What's it, blah, 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 blah. And as soon as Train hit, they became his biggest.
Well, now
probably
so. Now that's a little before me. When I came to Philadelphia, Train was on his way up. See, he was on his way, and I didn't hear all the musicians that I heard speak of Train. Only had the greatest admiration for him. I have to say, from you know, I wasn't in the circle like you were then.
Right,
I just come to town.
But you know, but I mean, when a guy
they had the greatest respect for this man.
Oh, listen,
always.
Of course, but what I'm speaking of is this: like, nobody actually understood Train when he first started turning his thing around and over. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, a lot of musicians couldn't understand where he was going.
Now, what era are you speaking about? What years
I'm
are you speaking of?
I'll say, 52.
Oh, even then.
Yeah, 52. Well, you can see traces of it, and McCoy. Yeah. When him and McCoy got together, that was a perfect match.
Yeah. But Train was developed by
then.
He
could convey.
He had come full circle then.
Oh, yeah.
By the time he and McCoy
got to convey that, you know, for McCoy to be sympathetic to him.
Well, McCoy is a genius.
Of course he is. You know, let's face it.
Goes without saying.
He's adaptable to that.
Sure.
And like Dizzy brought an arrangement into the band one time with Frankie Fairbanks and nobody could play it. Flatty Fistle on it. Get it out of here. It sounds terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Chavis is in the band. You know, the guys who could really play went on to become greater later on.
Jack Fields, how did you find people reacted to Coltrane when you started playing in Philadelphia? Were musicians, do you think, receptive to him? And what about audiences?
Well, I used Coltrane as a single. Not only Coltrane, but I used people like Clifford Brown, who they had a statement to make. Coltrane had a statement to make. And when he would come into the club, I used him with Bird, which was almost incongruous, but it worked because they respected the fact that anybody I would bring in to support an act not only not necessarily needed support, but it would do something for everybody involved. It would make it a stronger week, more meaningful week. So he was always accepted when I used him. What goes on between musicians afterwards, there's a grapevine that you're probably not aware of.
Everybody ego trips.
Right,
you know?
There's a grapevine, and they form in little groups, the groupies, and cliques, and they say, this is the only way it's done. You're either playing this style, or you're not in.
I remember, I don't mean to cut you off, Jack Fields, I hope you continue your thought, but I remember when I first came to Philadelphia, it's a pianist from Philadelphia, very good pianist, I'm not going to call any names either. So I was very curious. I'd ask questions of everyone when I came to Philly. So he told me, he said, well, Sam, I'll tell you one thing. You either, there's only two ways to get in. Either play your way in or you have to know somebody to get in the clique. So,
well, they had their inner circle.
Yes.
Right?
On the gig?
I would listen to a Bud and I'd shake my head. I said, well, I'll never get in.
But there was another guy, Bud Powell, saying we played.
I listened to Ray Bryant. He played so well as a youngster.
Oh, absolutely.
Were there musicians in Philadelphia, like maybe Ray Bryant, who a lot of musicians in the city seem to gravitate around, you know, and who really just had a lot of influence?
I understand what you're speaking of, but like Jack is saying, like John Coltrane always had a certain following, people that he appealed to spiritually, I think, to his approach to playing, you know. And him and, well, I'll say Bobby Timmons, Lee Morgan, I think he had his followers. Do you think so, Sam?
Yeah, I think Jack has an idea about Ray Bryant that you brought out. I'd like to hear it.
Yes. Ray was too new on the scene, just like John Coltrane was, to have any vast following as such, or a cult formed by that time. He was just in his formative stages. And the fact that he had this opportunity to meet so many different types of musicians gave him a chance to from the nucleus that he had to form into something that he could call his own.
But all the musicians knew he could play.
Exactly. See, right. These were top musicians that he was exposed to.
Sure.
And Ray Bryant started to become
sure. Remember Neil O'Day was there with him at your club one time? Yes. Neil O'Day,
oh, certainly. Do I remember? What a wild combination that is.
Did you ever have prayers in your place?
Yeah. Lester, in fact, I brought Lester Young to work a week with Billie Holiday, which I thought was a great inspiration on my part because they.
How did it work out?
Yeah, how did you do
financially? Pretty well. We won't discuss how we did financially.
Herb Keller, Sam Smith.
It was pretty sad.
Herb Keller's friend, Sam Keller, when I worked there with the showboat with Prez, it was Eddie Mathias, the bass player, Tootie Heath was playing drums, and. Prez always had these funny sayings, you know, so we're discussing saxophone players. Jimmy Olive had come down and played a little bit and all the guys.
Yeah.
And so we was talking to her. They had the favorites, you know, Ben Prez is real quiet. Ben Webb's, I like Ben, I like that. So Prez summed it up and says, well, everybody likes what they like, you know.
Very profound, right? Everybody likes what they like.
Which is very descriptive of his attitude.
You mentioned a moment ago, I just wanted to, one little aside was Julian Adderley. I was very much involved with Julian. I used to bring Cannonball in from Florida as a single by himself for Larry Bennett from the ABC, Associated Booking Corporation. And the only time that Julian Adderley would go out on the road, he was a school teacher.
Yes.
And I think at
yes.
Tallahassee High or...
He wrote the school song.
Some high school in Florida. And he would come to my club on the holidays when he wasn't. They'd had a week off Christmas time. They had a week off during the Easter holidays. That's where he'd come east and play for me. And I'd put a band around him. Sometimes I'd ask him to bring his brother Nat. And I'd use Ray Bryan or Fats Wright. And I'd use Ellis or somebody like that on drums and form a little group around him. And it was myself and Larry Bennett that sat down one night. I had Larry Bennett come down with John Hammond to listen to Ray Bryan and Julian Adderley and Nat Adderley and say, this could make something. So Cannonball asked me, what should I do, Jack? Should I leave school? That's security. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
we sat and made a decision that this is for you to do. This is the thing for you to do because everybody wants to hear
that
you.
It was a great decision.
Have you ever been surprised by looking back and seeing who has become really famous and who has gotten the big recording contracts and who has, in spite of their talents, gone completely unnoticed by recording companies, by large audiences?
Yeah, there are guys like that.
Well, can you give me some examples of both people who you were surprised became famous and people who you thought should have and didn't?
Well, Stanley Clarke was the latest one. He left town with us about 9 years ago on his first job, and now he's rich and famous. But there were guys like Eddie Miles, a piano player, and there was a guy named Foots Wallace, two piano players. And back in this early period, say late 38, 39, the piano players played without bass and drums.
That's true.
And people would get up and dance. Now, can you imagine what kind of time, what kind of feeling these guys had? And Foots Wallace wrote a tune with Jitterbug Waltz. Now, most of the guys play it now. This is 35 years later. But this guy, Eddie Miles, would play that in such a way that you could imagine how could a guy like this, nobody would know a guy like this. And and him and Foots Wallace would play the greatest time. Billy Kyle was piano player, was with Lucky Miller.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
And he was a learned pianist, you know, he knew all about it. But Foots would play behind him at White's Wanderer in 17th and Federal.
Yeah, you're telling it all then.
And but to guys like this, I think, should really, like Scott Joplin, nobody heard. But these guys were really amazing. Eddie Miles and Foots Wallace, these two guys I know, that could have played piano anywhere for anybody, but they were never even there.
Well, now, most of the musicians that I know that made it, I knew were going to make it anyway, you know, because they just had the ability. Now, there are some who are more famous than others, but one thing that sticks in me today, there are a lot of young musicians who are famous who don't really deserve that. You know, and they're much more famous than the Ray Bryants. They're doing much better. Although Ray Bryant's not doing bad. He's in Norman Grant's stable.
He's in the chips.
That's not bad at all. But when you compare him with a Stanley Clarke who's living in Beverly Hills, who's doing the big rock shows and
producing.
You know, it's no comparison. And I'm quite sure Stanley Clarke, from what I hear, is a fine bassist. But I'm quite sure, I don't think he has the quality of a Ray Bryan. The young guys just didn't have the exposure to the music.
You said you hit the point right there. The area of exposure is so much larger now than it was even when Burnham started.
Well,
I'm
speaking more of quality.
Yeah, right. See, I understand what you mean.
The quality just isn't around today. It's nobody to listen to. When I was coming up, I had Ray Bryan to listen to. I heard you. I had Bud to listen to. But the young fellas, they don't have too many people to listen to today.
Well, Sam, I think that maybe economics could be accountable for a lot of that. Because the best musicians are in the post office. I know the guys that came along when I came along that really could play. They went in the post office or something.
True.
Secure, in that way.
Jack, what's your reactions to people who have not become famous, who you thought were really talented, and people who have maybe become famous and you were surprised at their fame?
I don't feel it happens that way. I think in most cases, of course, the music business per se is a very difficult field to break into, but talent usually, what I have seen, talent will sooner or later tell. Whether you become a top drawer star, or this is relative, or whether you just make a living and are respected as a musician. There are plenty of musicians who make a decent living, but they don't become the top drawer money. They're not the $10,000 a week Oscar Peterson.
Right. Well, then that's, again, economic conditions. If you have a family and you get a job because it's paying the circus. Yeah, you got to make that week in the circus. The next week you come back to a...
Exactly. And you're forewarned. That if you're going to become a musician, you're practically a circus performer anyway. So
I think Jack's speaking more or less of that gigantic talent, like an Oscar Peterson. Circumstance his personal life would have, he'd stand out.
Oh, sure. People would sooner or later have to recognize him.
Oh, yeah.
A guy like Earl Hines. Now, there's a guy that transcends any time period.
Yes,
he sit down at the piano by himself. Right. You understand what I mean? There's a guy like that.
But there's certainly a period, I think, when he didn't have a lot of concert bookings and when he wasn't making.
Oh, absolutely! Every musician.
Forgotten
every musician. Sure.
And when you talk about
let me just reintroduce who you are for those of our listeners who are just joining us now. We're talking about jazz in Philadelphia, and we're talking about it as it has spanned a number of decades from the 40s up until now. My guests are Jimmy Golden, who is a pianist, and in the 40s was the house pianist at the Downbeat and at Billy Kretschmer's. He later left Philadelphia and joined the Billy Eckstein band. Sam Dockery is with us. He is a pianist and was a house pianist in Philadelphia at the Showboat, the place that later became the Bijou. He was the house pianist there in the early 60s. My third guest is Jack Fields, who was the owner of the club, The Blue Note, that brought in a lot of very excellent musicians to Philadelphia, and that was a club that operated from about 1950 to 1956. Do you think that the meaning of a club has changed from the 40s and the 50s to the 70s? No, because
yes, it has. Because
there aren't many house bands now. For instance, people don't get booked for more than two
again
three
economics.
Days.
You can't come out anymore like you used to. I used to go around the clubs and sit around, play all night. All the musicians, the guys would let them in. But today, with the price of everything, like if you're selling drinks or beer, you got to have almost a sure thing, to come in. So the atmosphere is not conducive for young guys to come around to learn how to play. Like Sam says, during that period, which is bad.
Yeah.
Which is terrible.
I think the economics has changed also. You can no longer go to a club and stand around as such.
That's why
I worked last week. I was speaking to Jimmy Golden and Jack Fields about my playing with Eddie Lockjaw Davis Monday at a club in South Philadelphia called Stars.
I heard it was great.
It's a very nice little club, nice atmosphere. They have the lighting in there, but the piano was hideous. But still, they charge quite a bit of money to get in now. Sure. That's a must.
That's a,
and also, it's not as relaxed. I believe they have two shows. I don't know exactly what this policy was, but you pay your $6, you come in, and you hear the first show. Then after the first show is over, they usher you out, then they let another group of people come in for the second show. And you must pay that $6. I don't know whether any drinks are involved, because I haven't been there yet as a patron. Right. I worked there.
See, but that's an explanation of what's going on. When you say they have two shows, and yet they're putting on a presentation of something for an audience to listen to.
Yes.
Now, is it a show, or is it a listening concert? Mm-hmm. That there's a definition here that is needed, because people are no longer satisfied to go out and just listen to Jimmy Golden play the piano. They want to know who Jimmy Golden is. Does he have a personality? Does he have a soul? What's he made of? You see, on television, they can see all this. They get to see the person. They get to know the person. It becomes a personality situation. And they're no longer willing. People would walk into the Blue Note, and it wouldn't be a sound. Everybody would be silent, and they'd listen, whether it be Chico Hamilton, whether it be Oscar Peterson. And there wouldn't be a sound in the room, and there was never any association between Oscar Peterson and the audience. He never had to come down and greet them or know them or be a part of that.
Did you see that happening, though?
But today they want to know who this person is. They want to get to know.
Well,
whether
see,
this person has a personality.
Records are responsible too, a lot for that, too.
So the musicians that do have personalities are those, that's what my point is coming to. For instance, Oscar Peterson has developed a personality. I don't know if you've seen him recently.
See him singing on TV?
He's a personality, whether he wants to be or not. And in order to be top drawer and hold that kind of an audience, to go into a concert hall and get the money he's going to get,
well, do you think his playing is as direct now as full cycle with him and Ray and Thicke being the greatest trio of all time?
No, I don't think he's doing or saying what he used to say, and that's another part of this scene. And that is, they complain and they complain and they complain, and I'm talking about musicians, about having to work in saloons. Okay, this terrible scene about saloons.
Well, I love
but all of the good music that ever happened.
Only in a saloon it can only happen.
That's the only place it can happen.
Why do you say that, sir?
Well, I went to see Oscar Peterson, who I have the greatest respect and admiration for. I went to see him at Valley Forge Music Fair. So the announcer brings him on. Now we present, ladies and gentlemen, the great Oscar Peterson. So naturally, everybody's waiting with abated breath and quiet. Not a relaxed atmosphere at all. But Oscar, through it all, seemed very relaxed. Now, being a jazz musician myself, in order to play well, you've got to be relaxed. Now, Oscar had a program mapped out to play for that audience. You know, he had to astound that audience, which he did.
He's got the equipment. He can do it, too.
But
he's not going to take any
creatively,
chances.
No, absolutely not. And the club is, jazz is taking chances. That's the whole essence. That's it and everything. So creatively, I wasn't too satisfied, although I was amazed technically. His left hand was phenomenal.
Sure.
You know, he did things. Sure. But as far as any creative beauty or any feeling, as far as creativity, I must say it.
Well, so
I think lacking that. And under the circumstances, it would have to be.
Of course, because you have to sacrifice, you have to make a compromise, your integrity to a degree in order to make money. You have to. That's
well, just like Jack said, it's a show.
Sure.
Presenting two shows.
Let me ask you, Sam and Jimmy, you've both been house pianists. There aren't many house pianists now. Most of the clubs don't have.
Not many houses.
And most of the clubs don't have their own band. If they're going to have. Some of the clubs have like an opening act, maybe a comedian opening for the band.
Right.
But there's not a house band. Was it a good gig to be a house pianist? I mean, was it secure? Did it pay well? Was it good for you as a musician?
It's like
growing it. Did you know?
Terry, it's like Sam was just saying. You take a chance. Personality conflicts, like all-star records, there's never been a sensational all-star record where the guys play like Dizzy Slam or never. So if you run across a personality, like I worked last week with Sonny Stitt, well, first of all, the personality is, do you know this tune? Do you know that tune? That's impossible to know every tune, right?
Well, but, don't you think that's room for growth?
Look, let me tell you.
Sure. Which is house pianist.
The last 4 days with Sonny Stitt, reaffirmed, I've been playing all different kind of gigs. You understand what I mean? To make a buck, because I have a family.
You're capable.
But the challenge is welcome, just like Sam says, because it challenges you to think.
Yeah, well,
you think independently. Now, on your regular commercials, all you got to do is, well, are they dancing or what are they doing? Play that, right? But this way, and I think it's a challenge, and it's great in that respect. But of course, like everybody has a little ego attached to them. You know, you never want to be told that you're stupid. You know, and it's like Barney Kessel came on the gig down there and had the bass player and the drummer. So he says, "No, I don't like going to play with any electronic." You know, so you can imagine to sympathize with the house bands. Or guys' feelings, you know. That's one aspect of it. But like Sam says, it's great. It's a great challenge. I got as much as a kick.
Oh, yeah. For me, it was invaluable being a house band because I got to meet the good musicians. I myself, in the growing period, I found that was absolutely necessary.
And by the way, Sam, you sure sound good, man. I'm telling you, you got me digging out all kind of books and
Please.
Everything. I'm going to tell you. You really sound good, man.
Jack Fields, we're talking about the importance of clubs and clubs that have house bands. Everyone agrees that your club, the Downbeat, in the 50s was a really terrific club. You had to abandon it. Why?
The Blue Note.
I'm sorry, yeah.
Straight.
Why? Well, the musician no longer was able to perform in a small, limited capacity. He had to go out into the concert field because the record industry had taken, I'm talking about the stars of our era, stars of the period that we're discussing now, Charlie Parker and Dave Brubeck and Jerry Mulligan. He had to take his, because the agency had made a star out of him, he had to take his act and go before an audience of 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 people. So they priced themselves out completely, whereas someone like myself, who had spent years, arduous years of working with these musicians, forming bands, getting groups together with them. I put Clifford Brown with Max Roach as an example. Could no longer bring that. Dave Brubeck was getting $12,000 and $15,000, and I had brought him to the East Coast with an understanding he would play for me three times a year for $2,000. Each time he came in for $2,000, I lost money on him. So imagine what I would lose if I would go for a $12,000 tab. I never made money in that place per se. So after 6 years, I decided now's the time. Either cut or else.
Oh, sure, I can.
Or else go down permanently.
Absolutely.
Because.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
I think one of the sad things about jazz that I've found is that, I don't know whether Jack agree, I think it's the lack of. I try to impress this fact upon my musician friends, that jazz needs some salesmanship in this country. You know, I may be wrong. You know,
some
people say, well, it's like classical music. You get your following and that's it. But I think jazz needs a little more than that. It needs a little more push because it's not as old as classical music. It's still an art form. But let's face it, classical music's been around for,
What about country
centuries.
West and all these guys
and
are making money?
Jazz has only been around, goodness, as far as classical music is concerned, it's still a baby. You know, in the next 30 years or so.
It has to be the guys in jazz have to do the selling themselves.
Absolutely.
So they're turning the public against them when they go out on a concert and turn their back to the audience.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Listen, we're almost out of time. Maybe we can continue this another time on Fresh Air and talk some more because there's so much that's been left unsaid. I'd like to find out, is there a place that we can hear you both play, or should we just keep our eyes on the newspapers and see where you'll be?
Just keep your eyes on the newspapers for me.
Ditto.
Okay.
You want to know where I am, Terry?
Yeah, you're at a restaurant now.
I just opened a restaurant this week. It's called Cayuga 30, and it's out on Lancaster Avenue in Wayne. So come on out and have a good steak.
Okay.
Yeah, a new one.
Listen, I want to thank you all so much for being here. It's really been a great pleasure to have you here, and I hope we can do it again sometime.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you, Terry.
I've had three guests in the studio. My guests have been pianist Jimmy Golden, who during the period that we were talking about was the house pianist at the Downbeat, and also at Billy Kretschmer's. He played with the Billy Eckstein Band. He's playing around the Delaware Valley again. Keep your eyes open for places where he'll be.
Beautiful guy, too.
pianist Sam Dockery, who during the time we were talking about was the house pianist at the Showboat. He's also played and recorded with Art Blakey. Again, keep your eyes open for where he'll be playing in the Delaware Valley. He was just at Stars last week. And my third guest was Jack Fields, who from about 50 to 56 owned the Blue Note, a club with a very excellent reputation in the Philadelphia area, and he's now in the restaurant business. Thanks again, all of you, for being here. I really enjoyed it.